Right, now, if you've listened to the show for any length of time, you will know that I am an ardent supporter of organ donation and encourage everybody to at least think about registering, to at least do the reading, ask the questions, and consider it. It's something I'm absolutely passionate about, but I can talk until I'm blue in the face. The fact remains, many people remain skeptical about the process. They have misconceptions about it. There are cultural objections in some cases. And there is also the issue of communication around it that often results in families refusing to authorize organ donation, even if they know that it was actually the wish of the deceased. So for the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to do a bit of a deep dive into the subject with somebody who deals with the life and death consequences of the organ donation decision every day, and who is determined to improve education around the topic, not just for the public, but also for his fellow medical professionals. With me in studio is Dr. David Thompson, who's a critical care specialist and a transplant surgeon at Grotesquare Hospital and UCT. And of course, in that role, has been witness to countless positive outcomes, the second chances that have been the gift of an organ donor, but also to the missed opportunities and the lives that have been lost because a donor wasn't available when one was needed. He's really passionate about the subject. He's helped develop an online course with UCT to educate his fellow medical professionals, as well as students and the general public as well, on the topic. And it's called Organ Donation from Death to Life. They're about to launch a new edition later this month. It actually happens to be Organ Donor Month during August, so very fitting time to have David with us. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks very much, Pippa.
I mean, as a surgeon, you must be witnessed almost daily to the impact organ donation can have and the impact its absence can have. Nobody likes to think about it and talk about it, though, David, until it's them on a waiting list or their family member.
Yes, it's a very difficult thing, because if I ask people remote from the grieving process, they will intrinsically say, I support this. But it's a very different matter to try and approach a grieving family at that time of end of life and get the informed consent that's needed for us to proceed. We require the clinical teams, not the transplant teams, to identify the potential for donors, make the referral at the appropriate time, and maintain that the patient in a condition where donation can still work out, and communicate that clearly to the family. And only once the family understands where the process is and where medical support has got to, is the right time to ask for permission for organ donation. You don't want to bring it up too early, and you don't want to leave it too late either. So it's really important that how you champion it, that we discuss it offline, away from the grieving process, that your family knows what your wishes are, because they will always be approached, and they need to actually give the permission. So that's where we are. That's where the message sometimes gets lost. We think it happens by default, but actually it's a very complicated process with a lot of moving parts that all need to fit together for it to actually work out for people.
You know, I'm thinking of a conversation I had a couple of weeks ago with somebody who said to me, I am a registered organ donor, but I haven't told my family because I know that they will object. It's not in line with their cultural beliefs. And that person didn't realize that at the end of the day, it's not his decision to make. It's that very family who will have to provide that final okay for it to go ahead in the event that something happens to him. Is that a common misconception that you grapple with, David, that people think, well, I've signed up, I've filled out the forms, I've got the green sticker on my driver's license, that's all that I needed to do?
Yes, I think it is. I think some of our information comes from overseas TV shows where the systems are completely different. And that is the case in South Africa. Being on the organ donor registry is an expression of intent. It's very good to sign up, because if you think about how you phrase the question, it should be asked by a trained requester, so someone who knows the process and the ins and outs, so ideally someone more closely linked to the transplant team and those processes, because many of those questions come through at that time, what happens now? And if the treating doctor can't answer that, then it doesn't quite complete the circuit in terms of what would happen after death. Is a forensic post-mortem required? Is this still possible? So we try and get those points across. But it does come down to approaching your family. It's not an advance directive. And if you think about how you would phrase the question to a family member, that you would actually say, what would this person have wanted to come out of the situation? Because that family member is actually acting as your surrogate decision maker in that situation. And that happens in ICU for ventilation decisions and other treatments. And it's important to phrase it as you're actually acting on that person. You know that person the best, what they would have have wanted to come out of the situation. So do mention it to the family, because when it gets brought up as a topic, that's how the question would actually be put to them.
That's important to know. I mean, if we look at the numbers in South Africa right now, I believe our figure is that in South Africa we have 1.6 donors per million people of population. Is that correct?
Yes.
It's low.
It is very low. And you must draw comparisons to other countries. Mm. So to give you some perspective, Spain would clock in at around 47 donors per million population. They have a very high ICU bed ratio to their population. They manage to get patients into well-trained ICUs for end of life. We're often forced to do it in the emergency departments, and a lot of our donors come through from there because we can't access the ICUs because there's such a shortage of resources that they're always getting allocated to a better candidate who could potentially survive.
Yeah.
One of my arguments that I try to put across is I still think that it's very worthwhile devoting 24 hours of donor management, because you can actually, if you add up all the life years gained from a liver, a heart, two kidneys, a pancreas, lungs, it gets to about 54 life years gained for all those recipients. For 24 hours work, that's a very good investment in terms of healthcare resources that filters through, and the treating teams aren't often aware that that's actually where the benefit comes, and we need the system to acknowledge that.
It's such a tough call if you're the person in charge of those beds, and as you say, there is a person who potentially could survive. You can understand why they'd make the decision to say, well, we're going to put that person in the bed. But what you're saying is the sum involved here balances out more than adequately on the side of investing. And obviously the ideal is to have enough beds to be able to do both at the same time. Now, I'm interested to hear that Spain, okay, so that's the ICU rate and availability of beds that's so key. Because Spain, as far as I know, is not an opt-out country. There is this, I know Switzerland voted in May to become an opt-out country where you are assumed by default to be a potential organ donor unless you have specifically asked not to be, rather than the situation we have here in South Africa where you have to opt in. Spain's not, though. Spain is the same as us, isn't it?
No. So Spain is also opt-out.
It is opt-out.
It's quite interesting to see how they got to be so good. If you go back historically, they did pass presumed consent legislation.
Okay.
But actually, they had no improvement in their deceased donor rate until 10 years afterwards. And what they did 10 years afterwards to affect their change was they put a transplant coordinator in every ICU.
Oh.
They built in quality assurance systems. They made a central coordinating authority to look after deceased donation. And that's when they started to make the structural improvements necessary. And various countries are now trying to follow that model. We often think that we just change our consent system and we solve the problem. Spain still routinely asks the family for consent. So they always do it. And they have about an 18% refusal rate.
Okay.
So just because by default you're assumed, it's still the same principle of having a trained requester ask the family. They have a refusal rate, that they don't just proceed without permission.
Without any shackles involved. So that centralized sort of structural model you said many countries are trying to emulate, is South Africa one of them?
So we're trying in various ways through the professional societies, the engagement with the Department of Health. So I think that is ultimately where we have to go. We're a very hospital-centered system. So it's the transplant centers that are driving these initiatives. And actually, if you think about it, good end-of-life care should be driven across all hospitals, regardless of your transplant status. And I think that's the big shift that we need to get in terms of quality improvement and assurance, in terms of making sure no potential for donation goes unmissed. And for me, it's really important that we as the doctors don't make paternalistic decisions about what a family would want in end of life. Mm. And we should really keep the option on the table and, as a standard of care, offer it to the family every time in a very compassionate way.
When it's done the right way, I'm thinking of an interview I did, it's probably more than a year ago now, with the mother of a 13-year-old boy who died in an absolutely freak accident, walking his dogs, fell and hit his head. And she spoke to us about their decision to donate Nathan's organs and what it had meant to them, how hard it was at the time, but how much they valued that decision down the line. So as you said, that moment of the intense grief and emotional fraught situation you're in at the time of having to make the decision, they did have some questions. They did waver, but they ultimately decided that this could make some meaning out of what had happened, out of an absolutely senseless event. And she then said to us that a year down the line, they were so grateful to be able to mark Nathan's birthday and the anniversary of his death with the knowledge that five or six other people were alive and living with their families because they had made that decision. But it a lot of it comes down to the way they're approached at that point. So I really hear what you're saying. I mean, David, your course is obviously designed to help guide that communication and educate the person who might find themselves having to ask that question for the first time ever in their career. You've been running it for several years now. I mean, what sort of feedback are you getting from particularly the medical professionals who've done it?
So it's been really interesting to see, because when we created it through the University of Cape Town, it was an engagement with, for me, the main campus, where they put a learning designer and helped us create the curriculum, because it didn't exist in the medical school undergraduate curriculum beyond a couple of lectures. It wasn't synthesized down. We do teach informed consent in a certain lecture. We do teach the diagnosis of brain death. We do teach communication skills. But to synthesize it all down into a continuum for the students to conceptualize, I think was really, really important. It's quite interesting. It's been running for 4 years now, 5 years now, and we're close to having 4,000 graduates through the course.
Okay.
It's structured over 4 weeks. And it is a little bit heavy in the first week, because actually most people who sign up for the course are actually drop out after the first week. So we actually made it that you have to get through the informed consent modules and the brain death, because if someone walks away from the course knowing how we diagnosed brain death, how rigorous that process is, and that we have to get consent and we have to do that in the best way possible, then we've ticked a box. The other weeks, week two goes into donation after circulatory death, which is where certain situations at the end of life where care is deemed to be futile and the ventilator is withdrawn, there's a small subset of those patients who can potentially be considered for organ donation, but it requires a degree of logistical planning. And then we also cover what happens to the body afterwards, and try and complete the picture. Also consider tissue donation, because if you want to consider donation as routine at end of life, organ donation can only take place if there's a ventilator involved in terms of mechanical ventilation. But tissue donation, the window for recovery for corneas, the diagnoses that can actually cause death, could be a malignancy, and corneas could still be donated. So it's really important that time window is independent of the mechanism of death for tissue donation. I think if we want to change it as a culture in the country, we really have to include tissue donation
in that conversation
to make people comfortable with it.
We're talking to Dr. David Thompson, who is a transplant surgeon at Grotius Care Hospital and UCT. The conversation is going to continue after the 2:30 news headlines. If you have any questions, please send them now, either by voice note to 0725671567, or you're very welcome to call in on 021-446-0567. My guest in studio, Dr. David Thompson, who is a critical care specialist and transplant surgeon at Grotius Care Hospital and UCT, has been integrally involved in the development of a free online course which delves into, in depth, the issues around organ donation, the issues of how families are communicated with, how the request is made to consider organ donation, also delving into tissue donation and how that differs from organ donation, the ethics around the process, the cultural and religious objections in some cases, and even going into, in the final week, talking and looking at issues around organ trafficking and commercialization of donation, etc. So it's a really deep dive into many different facets of this conversation. Before we go back to David, I'd love to just share a voice note that's coming from one of you, and just to say you can pop it through to 072567 if you'd like to share a story or a perspective, if you've got a question, if you've been a recipient or have a family member who made the decision to donate. I think we've got one of those questions on the line right now. Let's take a listen.
Hi Pippa, my son died some years ago of a brain tumor at the age of 27, and we had no doubt in our minds at all that he would have wanted his organs to give life to somebody else who might have lost their life without it. And so I cannot tell you how much comfort that brought to me, and I know to the rest of the family, to know that somebody else was benefiting from such a tragic happening that really seemed to break us all for quite a long time. But that was a real positive that came out of it. And if I were younger, I would ask for mine to be used as well. But I think it's the most wonderful, wonderful thing to do. Just give life to somebody who would lose theirs otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I'm so sorry for your loss, but what a beautiful message. And David, I mean, that's the kind of ambassador you're trying to create in offering this course, to get people to looking at it from that perspective. But it's very hard to say to somebody who is in the thick of grieving and sudden loss that there could be a positive outcome, that you might look back on this and find that it brings you comfort. That's really hard. I mean, it's got to be done so delicately.
Yeah, it does. And sometimes we say, well, what if the family says no? Would they be traumatized by that request? But actually, if you look at the studies looking at it, the family is actually very happy that you got to the point of offering and you've had the discussions go that far. And it's actually the families who haven't been fully counseled who are the most unhappy with that process. And actually, organ donation for me is a reflection of the healthcare system actually following through on the whole package. So it's not felt to distress people if they actually ultimately say no, would they regret it a year down the line?
Yeah.
They're actually just very happy to have been offered at that setting and being empowered to make a decision.
Okay. Another message in from somebody saying, my mom was not a registered donor, but two people can see today from her cornea donation. Illustrating the potential ramifications of this decision. Another person sending a very heartfelt thank you because they are a recipient. Thank you for having this conversation. I'm a liver transplant recipient. I had a living liver donor who donated a portion of his liver to me, and I'm so grateful that I can continue living my life and that I feel so strong and healthy now. I work for the NPO TEL, which is Transplant Education for Living Legacies. This is the message we continue to push, to have the conversation with your loved ones and make it known that you are an organ donor. Another personal story here from Anonymous saying, a few years ago, on the day of my daughter's 13th birthday, a boy in her class died from an undetected heart defect. His family made the decision to donate his organs to four different donors. And distraught as my daughter was at the time, to this day, that decision had a profound effect on her. She is determined to donate her organs and encourage all of her friends to do the same. Now, that's a young person who's already made that decision. You heard that voice note reference something that several people are asking about, David, which is the age limitations on organ donation. Somebody saying, is it true that you can only donate your organs up to the age of 65?
So, no. What I teach is that if a kidney got you to the age of 90 and it's a very good kidney, there's a very good chance that that kidney could give people a significant survival benefit and last them for many years. So for me, there's no upper age limit and it needs to get discussed. And each individual organ is assessed on its merit.
Right.
So it's not, I had hypertension, I have diabetes, I can't be a donor. There's an objective assessment of the organs that go on. And again, we don't want that discussion to be done by the treating clinician, because actually there's a context to that. So if there's a fulminant liver failure at Red Cross with 12 hours left to live, I might not want that for my own personal liver transplant because I'm not in that context of only having 12 hours to live with my fulminant liver failure. So there's a context for the priority listings that are going out nationally on a daily basis. And these patients don't have a dialysis option to wait, and they don't have living donor options. So it's really important that we get better with our deceased donation system.
Okay. We can squeeze in one last call. I'm so glad to have Corinne on the line to us from Johannesburg, I believe. Corinne, welcome.
Thank you very much.
What would you like to share with us today? I believe you are a recipient of a transplant donation.
Yes, I am. I had my liver transplant in October, on the 5th of October last year, so 2021, and a friend donated a portion of his liver to me. So that was really special. And because of him, I feel absolutely amazing now. For the last 3 or so years, I've been struggling quite a lot with liver failure. It was something that I was born with, but my body took a huge knock in 2019, and he stepped forward and donated a portion of his liver to me.
I mean, how do you even begin to thank somebody for literally giving you a gift of life, Corinne?
No, I have no idea, but he's been really, really amazing. It was something that I was really worried about. I was concerned that you know, you feel like you would owe somebody something like this. Because it's not like someone buying you a box of chocolates or something like that. Yeah, but he's been absolutely phenomenal. Our relationship is so much closer now, and he's just so down to earth. And I think there's both. We've spoken about it on numerous occasions where there's so much that we are both so grateful for from this whole process. That there's so much that he's given me. It's more than just life. I mean, I don't know how someone can top that. But he said that he's learned so much too. Yeah, and his family has been incredibly supportive. His mom messages me often. Yeah, it's been really, really amazing, and I'm so grateful for him. Yeah, because it's just been truly incredible.
Corinne, I'm so grateful for that call and for your ability to make it. Thank you very much for sharing a very personal perspective on the conversation. David, I'm mindful of the time marching away from us. I don't want to finish without doing two things. One is telling our listeners where they can sign up for your course, because again, as much as it is of use and intended to some degree for medical professionals, it is also of interest to anybody who wants to just develop a deeper understanding of the ethical and practical aspects of organ donation. If somebody listening wants to take part, how do they do so?
So they would just need to search on Coursera is the online platform. So it's an online university that the University of Cape Town's partnered with, and it's hosted on that platform. And then enroll. It runs weekly. So you sign up and they cohort people to start on a weekend. And then you can audit the whole course for free. They do ask you if you want a completion certificate. They'll try and put a little fee onto that. Okay. But you can easily apply for financial aid. And they just check if your IP address is from the developing world, and then they give it to you for free. So it's available to not just medical professionals. It's all contained in short 5-minute videos, in little sound bites for the modern attention span on different topics. And it is aimed to give a broad overview. So Coursera.org, and to just search for organ donation from death to life.
Won't you please just spell that for those who might not be
familiar? So Coursera.
Coursera. .org. And the name you are looking for is, let me just get it right, Organ Donation from Death to Life. The other important bit of information to share with you is, if you're listening to this and feeling inspired to finally go ahead with the registration process, don't forget about the Organ Donor Foundation, who does do such incredible work rallying for this cause. Their website is odf.org.za. It takes a matter of minutes to sign up. I can vouch for that, having done it myself several years ago. And it is a statement of intent. It is the beginning of a conversation that needs to continue offline with your family and loved ones, but it is certainly the first and very important step that you can take down that road. odf.org.za. Dr. David Thompson, anything you'd like to just share in closing with our audience listening today?
No, thank you very much for the invitation to come and talk. And it is Organ Donor Month, so the more we can talk about it this month, but it's a continual process. Keep spreading the message. It's an ongoing need. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the work that you're doing to create new ambassadors for the cause. And I really appreciate your very clear and succinct communication on air today. Once again, odf.org.za if you would like to register, and coursera.org if you'd like to sign up for the course.